you know, how much data you need to be 100% certain of anything. You can never have enough data to be 100% certain of anything. So I feel like it's a false god. You know, we feel like we've got all this gold in the data when really, you know, a bit like the story of Rumpelstiltskin, what we've got is a room full of straw that we perhaps can turn into gold, but it's not gold yet. And there are other kinds of data too that we're possibly ignoring, that right under our nose, you know, data, there's data in stories all around us.
Should you ever go with your gut, even when the data tells you otherwise? This is Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. I'm here to help you find the clues that will lead you to your calling. There's been an obsession with data and entrepreneurship over the past several years. When we're not sure about something, we're encouraged to run tests. And I've heard even the advice before, test everything. Like, really? Test everything? If you really know anything about statistics, you'll know that many things in a budding venture just don't have a large enough sample size to be tested. If you're testing literally everything, you'll get nothing done. And worse yet, your company will have no vision. Bernadette Jiwa agrees with me. She's author of the new book, Hunch, Turn Your Everyday Insights into the Next Big Thing. In it, she teaches you how to harness the power of your intuition, recognize opportunities other people miss, and create breakthrough ideas. Seth Godin, who you heard on episode 77, calls Hunch a modern classic. Pretty good endorsement. You can buy Hunch at cadavy.net/hunch. In this conversation, I talk with Bernadette about why is it that a hat salesman in New York did a better job at predicting the election results than data scientists like Nate Silver did? How did the shopping cart get invented? If the inventor had gone with the initial data, we might be stuck hauling baskets all over Whole Foods. Hunch is Bernadette's sixth book, so she has a lot of publishing wisdom that I was eager to soak up. She'll share her personal story about happily returning her advance check to a publisher. They wanted her to compromise her values. She wasn't cool with that. We'll also hear what Bernadette learned working closely with Seth Godin. She was the editor of Seth's giant book, This Might Work. And you know that you should save your energy for the things that bring you results in your business. And with SendPro from Pitney Bowes, you'll never have to waste energy standing in line at the post office again. With SendPro, you can print stamps directly from your computer, no special equipment necessary. Plus, you save money on postage. Visit pb.com/loveyourwork and try it free for 90 days. After that, you'll get SendPro for only $5 a month. Stamps.com is $15.99 a month. SendPro is only $5 a month. That's three times the features, one third the price. That's at PB as in peanut butter or Pitney Bowes, pb.com/loveyourwork. And you know, you could have been listening to this interview with Bernadette Jiwa weeks in advance. It's called Love Your Work Elite. And did you catch how I just changed the name from premium to elite? Well, I just did. Now it's Love Your Work Elite. With Love Your Work Elite, you hear ad-free interviews weeks in advance. You get fully produced episodes a couple of days early, too. Most importantly, you become a part of making this show. You become a part of putting Love Your Work's message out into the world. So far, the audio hosting expenses of Love Your Work are now fully listener-supported through Love Your Work Elite. Next up, I'd like to get the publishing assistance. That's the help that I hire to publish the episodes and show notes. Wouldn't it be awesome if that was fully listener-supported too? So I hope that you will sign up. You can help make it happen. It would feel great to have you a part of it. Go to cadavy.net/elite. That's cadavy.net/elite. All right, I'm here with Bernadette Jiwa, and I think that, Bernadette, our conversation today kind of seems like it's going to be like the big battle between data and intuition. I think, as you know, there's been so much lip service paid to, you have to bring data, you have to test everything in entrepreneurship today. But I think what you're arguing in this book is to connect with your intuition to create products that really break through. How do you see that relationship and that battlefield between these two forces?
You know, I think it's interesting. 10 years ago, we would have been relying on our intuition a lot more. Now that the more data we have, the more we feel like we don't have to take risks and we don't have to make those intuitive leaps because we can use data as a crutch, and that abdicates our responsibility for having made the wrong decision, which of course we're all afraid of, right?
Right. And I think that's one of the dangers of data is actually, I think it creates, data ironically kind of creates a bias where mm-hmm. you have the data, you ran the test, you ran the A-B test, and now you have this data that tells you this thing. And so now you believe that that thing is true. Or, you know, I feel like that's the way that most people do it. Maybe if people who are doing it very rigidly and doing it correctly, maybe they're reaching proper conclusions. But a lot of times people use it to support a belief or make a decision when mm-hmm. in fact they don't really have all the information. Is that accurate to you?
Well, even if we have, you know, how much data do you know do you need to be 100% certain of anything? You can never have enough data to be 100% certain of anything. So I feel like it's a false god. You know, we feel like we've got all this gold in the data when really, you know, a bit like the story of Rumpelstiltskin, what we've got is a room full of straw that we perhaps can turn into gold, but it's not gold yet. And there are other kinds of data too that we're possibly ignoring that right under our nose. You know, there's data in stories all around us.
Right, so we're not necessarily always, we might have some data, but we don't. But then in the process of paying attention to that data and focusing on that data, it can cause us to ignore other data.
Exactly. You know, the U.S. presidential example and Brexit, you know, if we look at the political scene at the moment, which is pretty topical, being cases in point where we possibly knew what people were saying they were going to do. We made predictions. Our political forecasters made predictions. And we didn't really know what was in people's hearts.
Yeah, let's look at that a little bit. I mean, I think there is what you're saying is that, you know, maybe you have a poll or something and people aren't necessarily, maybe for one reason or another, they don't want to share what mm-hmm. what their view is. But then there's also this idea of, you know, say with the U.S. presidential election, there was data suggesting that one candidate was gonna mm-hmm. was gonna win, 70% chance. Another candidate had 30% chance, and everybody just kind of wrote off that second mm-hmm. candidate. But actually, if you're really understanding data and you're understanding statistics and probability, then, you know, in 3 out of 10 worlds, this other candidate wins. So there's that element too.
Yeah. And let me tell you a story, David, about a couple of weeks before the presidential election. I was visiting New York and, my husband was here with me. He was at a behavior summit, and, you know, there were people there who, like Nate Silver, who were presenting, and Nobel laureates, and everybody was saying, you know, it was, I think, as much as 90% certain that Hillary Clinton would win. And I think the day after, we were taking a walk outside the Rockefeller Center, and we met a guy who was selling hats. He was selling beanies emblazoned with the candidates' names. And he said to us, there's going to be a big upset. Trump's going to win this election. And we looked at him as if he was, you know, some kind of lunatic, because we'd been listening to the experts. And he said, I can't sell. Trump hats are selling like hotcakes. And he'd been having conversations with people on the ground, on the street, looking into people's eyes, and he understood the truth that possibly the experts didn't.
Huh, that's actually kind of ironic too, because, if you know, one of the theories is that, you know, you have the polls and maybe people don't want to share their position, but if you're selling hats on the street, now I don't know if that's based off of like how many hats he was selling, but if somebody buys a hat with a candidate's name on it, and they're going to wear it on the street or something, then you know, they're obviously being open about it. So, you know, there's some complexity of human behavior perhaps behind that, if that's the case.
And isn't that what it's like in the real world in terms of, you know, which idea will fly or not, knowing which idea will fly or not. There's all that complexity around human behavior, and emotion comes into it. So you can't just take a rational worldview of it, because you're trying to assess what irrational human beings are going to do next.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that, because I think that this is, you know, this to me is like the big tragedy of being really obsessed with data. And I think it kind of maybe started with The Lean Startup, which, great book, fantastic book, but people missed that in the book, Eric Ries warns, like, we can't turn data into a new religion. We have to still be in touch with the founder's vision and all these things. Mm-hmm. And then it became this craze. And I feel like it's starting to go into, to check itself a little bit.
Yeah. Because what we're losing there in that nuance is the characteristics, as Eric quite rightly points out there, and I expand on that in my book, which is, there are certain characteristics that visionary entrepreneurs have, and they're not things that we can't cultivate in ourselves. So I don't want people listening to think, well, you know, you have to be a special person in a special place and live in Silicon Valley to come up with breakthrough idea or meaningful products and services. That's not what I'm saying at all. In fact, quite the opposite. We can all cultivate those things. And there are three characteristics or traits, which are creativity, empathy, and imagination. And that's, I think, partly what Eric was alluding to, which is, you need to be empathetic about the people you want to serve. You need to have an imagination about what the future is going to look like. So you know, you can't make an intuitive leap or come up with a breakthrough idea with just on data alone.
Yeah, and when you were talking about, we can't really necessarily predict what humans are going to do next, I think that's a really interesting thing, because there can be, you can go ahead and say you're just starting your lean startup and you run a little test, and, you know, provided that you actually understand statistics when you're running your test, you might still come up with a conclusion where, like, oh, well, people clearly aren't into this thing. I ran some Facebook ads that had this headline on it, and it underperforms versus the other things. I mean, does that necessarily mean that this idea of yours is not worthy? Do we not have counterexamples to that of things that maybe people are resistant to at first, and then they eventually catch on?
Or on the flip side, ideas that sound great, something like a Google Glass or a Segway, which in theory might sound like they would work in the real world, and in fact didn't, because they perhaps neglected to think about what real world people would use them for, and how it would feel to walk into a bar with glass on, and how other people would react to you. So, and then on the flip side of that, you've got somebody like Sarah Blakely, the founder of Spanx, women's shapewear, who really understood what it was like to be a woman who was dissatisfied with her appearance in a pair of pants, and set about solving that problem, because she knew other women would feel the same.
I also liked your story. I think the story is actually from Difference, which is that of the guy who invented the shopping cart.
Yes, it is. And it's in my TEDx talk. So, you know, that's a long time ago. He was just watching his customers. I think he was based in Oklahoma. He had a supermarket, and he was watching his customers shopping. And he saw that they stopped shopping when their baskets became too heavy or too full. And he decided to do something about it. And he literally built the shopping cart. And if we're talking about A-B testing and testing the idea out, he initially found that people weren't using them because, as you said in your lovely review of A Hunch, that men didn't want to look effeminate and, you know, not look tough having to push this shopping cart around. So he had to figure out how to tell the story in a way that would make the shopping cart more appealing to people. So he had to show them that other people were using it. So he actually employed people to push the carts around initially to say, look, people like you do things like this.
Yeah. And I think that he also hired store greeters in the beginning to teach people how to use the carts. And then I think that's where he started to maybe pick up some of these clues from people might say like, you know, I guess I heard some of the women were saying, I've pushed enough baby carts. I'm not pushing another cart type of thing like that. And I think that that ties into some of the things that are in the book about that having a hunch, like working off of your hunch isn't necessarily, isn't just this random act of deciding like, oh, well, I think this is going to work. So let's do this. Can we break that down a little bit?
Yeah. Well, a hunch is not a lucky guess when you think about it, because a guess is uninformed, you know, a coin flip or, you know, picking numbers for a lottery and, you know, having a 14 million to one. A hunch is informed by something, and it's what you notice. So your curiosity helps you to ask great questions and to notice things that are broken, what's not happening that should be happening, what's happening that shouldn't be happening, and then to, you know, recognize patterns in the environment, and that takes practice. So a hunch is informed, and a lucky guess is not informed by anything.
And so how do you sharpen that skill of having better hunches?
You pay attention to what's going on around you. You put your phone away. You look up. You ask questions constantly. You know, just sit in a cafe and look around you and listen to the stories that people or the conversations that people are having with one another. You know, humanity is just fascinating, and there's so much data in those stories.
Yeah, you actually introduce a methodology in the book. I believe it's like focus, notice, question, discern, predict, and test.
Yeah.
Can we break that down a little bit?
Well, focus starts, it's this whole piece around, you know, you can't consume and create. So you can't multitask your way to this. You can't have one eye here and one eye there. So you need to pay attention. You need to be a first class noticer. And, you know, then you make it, you think about a problem that you're interested in solving and make some connections. I mean, if you think about, I don't want to talk about Steve Jobs all the time, but he's one of those people who did that. I've been very deliberate in the book to bring up very ordinary case studies of people who came up with breakthrough ideas. But if we want to look at somebody who we hold up as an icon, he is one of those people who did exactly those things. He followed those steps. He was a first-class noticer. And another example from the book would be Debbie Sterling, who is the founder of Goldieblox, the girls' construction toy, who looked around her at Stanford and said, "Why are there so few female engineers? What's going on here?" And found that girls were not playing with construction toys as she didn't. She played princesses when she was a kid, and she happened upon engineering by accident through one of her teachers, who's, you know, because she was good at math. So, you know, this whole piece about asking questions and looking for answers in unexpected places and then connecting the dots to those solutions.
Well, let's go back to Debbie from Goldieblox, right? So she found, according to the research that she did, that the girls that she was studying, like, actually were more interested in stories when it came to playing with toys. Mm-hmm. And so she was able to sort of reverse engineer a toy that would then get girls interested in construction or through engineering things through stories, right? Like a character.
That's right. And what's interesting about her story is that the industry experts told her that girls don't play with construction toys and you can't fight nature. And she disproved that, because what she found was that the construction toys just weren't appealing to the girl's strengths, which were verbal skills. So what she did is marry the two things, verbal skills to help them develop their spatial awareness. And she found as soon as the girls were excited about, you know, they had to know who was building and why she was building it. And then they got excited about building something, not just creating a tower for the sake of it.
It kind of perhaps tells you that, you know, when people tell you that you can't do a certain thing, that's a great opportunity then to find out the reason why they're wrong. I mean, I could think of Airbnb would probably be a great example. Mm-hmm. I'm sure when they started, people were like, "What? Nobody's going to pay, mm-hmm. you know, to sleep on your couch."
Mm-hmm. One of the stories I tell in the book, and I know the Airbnb story has been told to death. One of the stories I tell in the book is that Brian Chesky offered, I think, 7 venture capitalists a 10% stake in Airbnb for $150,000. And today that 10% stake would be worth over $2 billion. And they all turned him down. And some people didn't even reply. They just weren't feeling it. They just didn't see the value.
Well, there were things happening with changes in technology that were making that opportunity possible, right? Like, mm-hmm. okay, yes, people don't want to sleep on people's couches, aren't going to pay to sleep on people's couches, right? But because of technology, they can create some sort of a reputation system, and then people can actually feel trust for booking a room in a place that they've never been, and it ended up working.
Isn't it interesting, though, that the technology is actually enabling the humanity, it's amplifying that, you know, it's the whole, what is it that people want? Well, they want reassurance, so we're enabling trust by helping people to make the reputation of people more visible. The same with TripAdvisor. I have never had such great service in hotels since TripAdvisor was born.
mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can imagine that, say, with Airbnb, they could if they could just have magically made an Airbnb site and with, you know, thousands of listings on it, right at the beginning, they might have found, oh, we don't actually have a lot of activity here. Well, I mean, this is a hypothetical, of course, but you know, that if they had that data, they would have found that data was actually not necessarily correct.
Well, if you dig deep into the Airbnb story, they were actually trying and failing for some time. You know, it wasn't an overnight success. And what enabled the key to their success was them actually coming. I think it was they came to New York and they visited 50 hosts and sat with them and asked them questions and got their stories. And that's how they worked out how to actually create the breakthrough. It wasn't just looking at the algorithm. It wasn't just focusing on the technology. It was actually hearing the stories of the people on the ground who were going to use the service.
Yeah, this is actually a design method, design methodology of you know, mental models, right? You interview somebody and you make a transcript of it, and you start to see these phrases in there where at first you just feel like, oh, they're just not into that. But maybe they just give you some kind of a clue along the way. And if you engineer and think through those, you can start to find spots where you can enter and change behavior.
Mm. So how do you do that as a designer?
Well, I mean, it's been a long time since I've done it, but you might hear somebody say, you might realize that somebody might express kind of anti-materialism attitudes in an interview, for example. And then you might find, well, but no, actually it's just that they don't like cars. And like maybe like the thing that they said is they don't like cars, but like they really love a beautiful watch. Mm. And there's something about that that makes them feel, that makes them feel a certain way. But I see a lot of these parallels in the methodology that you have introduced in the book. I mean, you have steps and exercises in there for sharpening these skills.
Mm. Yeah. And that's really deliberate. Because I want all of my books to be really actionable, not just about closing the book and having the last, you know, turning the last page and going, okay, I'm done now. And I want people to do things with the books because they are designed to help you take action and have an impact in the world.
Well, I guess I was really most fascinated by some of the stories that you have about that starting, about getting over that resistance of getting people to adopt something. So, for example, there was the shopping cart story, which is from your other other book. But then you also told a story about the adoption of the potato.
Yeah, that was from another book too.
That must have been from Difference as well.
Yeah, it is. But it's an interesting one, isn't it? It's, you know, it's the king trying to get people to eat potatoes, and people don't want to eat potatoes. And what he does is he creates a royal potato patch and has guards surround the potatoes and makes them covetable. And then people decide if they're worth guarding, they must be valuable. They go and steal them and start eating them. So it's all about how we make people feel. You know, as you alluded to in the story about the watch and the car, people don't really buy our products and services. They buy how it makes them feel. You know, the hotel I'm staying in at the moment is a classic example. This, as soon as you walk in, there's a certain smell that they're pumping out. And what I found out from these guys, from having some conversations here, is that they work with a scent marketing company and they create this specific smell in the hotel. And also the same company has worked, I think, with Sony to create a smell that makes women feel comfortable in with making decisions about purchasing technology. So they have, you know, married this, the two things, you know, feelings, rational and irrational, with decision making and understanding what it is that moves us to act. And it's not just, and never is, rational.
We're going to take a quick break. To live a balanced life and do your best work, you've got to sleep well. You also need to eliminate hassles. Hassles like shopping for a mattress. Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress for a shockingly fair price that you can get delivered to your door with no hassles. It combines supportive memory foams to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. And with over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars, Casper is quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. And I'm one of those happy customers. I had a Casper when I lived in Chicago, and if I lived in the U.S. again, I would immediately order another Casper. Casper is designed, developed, and assembled in the United States, and Casper has free shipping and returns to the United States and Canada. Try Casper for 100 nights, risk-free, in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/loveit. Use the promo code LOVEIT. Terms and conditions apply. That's really fascinating. So this idea of, you know, how you make people feel, is that something that, I mean, you're an author, you've written, is this your sixth book now?
It is, yeah.
It is your sixth book. Yeah, and I feel like this is something that I have examined myself as an author, is the titling, even if it's a blog post or the way that I name a podcast episode, and the way that you make somebody feel with what you title your book or what you say your book is about seems to have an influence on whether it's going to hit them or not. Is that something that you think about as an author?
All the time. I help companies and I help other authors to title their books. I also help companies to name things and position things and products and services. And definitely, it's very much so. And if you look at, you know, some of the titles of best-selling books, you'll see that in action all the time. It depends. So tell me some of the posts or the podcast titles that you've found have worked for you, and why do you think they have?
It's interesting. I've actually been playing around with the with the titles of some of the podcast episodes, because, you know, I guess I start before as a podcaster, I had been blogging for a long time, and there's certain moods or attitudes you're trying to elicit, I think, when you're blogging. Mm-hmm. So I can think of one earlier on where it was like one of my first episodes, and I titled it like, "Oh, don't let your baby get slaughtered." 'Cause it was one of the people that I interviewed, Adrian Holovaty. He sold his company to MSNBC and then watched them end up doing terrible things to it. And, you know, so then his next company, he decided that he wanted to retain ownership of that. Now, and that episode, for some reason, just wasn't getting the same number of downloads as some other ones. And then I started to play with the posture of the title. So, for example, I have a recent one, Why I Won't Write a New York Times Bestseller is the name of the blog post. We were just talking about that one before, but I've actually changed the podcast title to Why You Shouldn't Write a New York Times Bestseller. Because, and I can't put my finger on it, but when I imagine it, when I try to put myself in the mind of somebody who is not me, which I think is a lot of what you're talking about in Hunch, and when I try to have that empathy for that person, and I imagine, you know, you are on a bus or a train or in a car, and you're gonna choose something that's gonna play in your ear. And what does it feel like to have something play in your ear? Well, for me, it's this very intimate experience to have somebody talking in your ear. And it's very different from the types of things that you get to see shared on Facebook, where it's like, oh, here's another article about something you should be angry about. And so that's where I start to feel like, okay, it needs to be a little bit more empathetic to the listener in audio than, say, in writing.
It's great to hear you say that. So first thing, well done on that title, because of both of those really resonated with me. As an author, you know, Why I Won't Write a New York Times Bestseller, that really resonated with me. Secondly, you know, speaking to one person at a time, you've recognized that you're speaking to one person at a time, even though you're broadcasting to a lot of people. And I think that's something we forget when we're creating products and services, is that we're, you know, we might want to reach 5, 10, 100,000 people with our product, service, design, whatever it might be. And we need to do that one person at a time. So it's important to think about the you in that. And you've obviously, in changing the podcast title, you've given people the most powerful word in the English language, which is you. You'll notice that in a lot of book titles, you figures very prominently.
Yeah, and it's something I'm always trying to think about is what, how are you going to make somebody feel with the thing? And words have kind of, there's like two layers to words, like, and you can notice it, especially as a writer. You know, you and I think about the way that words make people feel, and it's something that you might not even notice, where maybe you might read a news article or something, and you start to feel maybe like a little bit of anger or indignation or something, and then you stop, and then you read it again, and then you see the words that are causing it, and you're realizing that you're being misled in somehow, you're being manipulated in some way, right? Like, if you're actually like looking at the meaning of the words that are being used, it's like, wait, a journalist shouldn't use that word. What are you talking about?
And also from the point of view of a creator, which I think a lot of the people listening are, we get to choose the kind of energy we put out into the world. You know, we can change people's day with the kind of words we use and the posture that we adopt. So I'm staying in New York, as you know, at the moment, and I've been riding cabs and Ubers and had it's amazing the different experiences you can have in getting in just moving from one car to another. The energy changes according to what music the driver has on, or you know how he's feeling that day. Like yesterday, I had a terrible day in Uber because the weather was awful. Everybody was honking. The driver was driving like a lunatic, and he bumped into an ambulance because you know he was pent up and he was really stressed out. Today it was a totally different experience. The guy had really calm music on. He was super calm. Nothing was a problem. And as creators, we have the power to do that. We've got enormous power to change how people feel. And how fantastic is that?
So have there ever been times, what about yourself? Have there been times along the way when you have learned to be more empathetic in your own writing or how you're titling books and such? Have there been times when maybe you had a book title that like later on you realize, oh, gosh, this is way better. I wasn't thinking about this right. Was there a turning point for you for that?
I'm probably the opposite. If I wanted to sell more books, I should probably make more, my titles a bit more edgy. My titles are probably a bit subtle, and that's quite deliberate because they're to appeal to a certain kind of person, not to everybody.
That's funny you mentioned that, actually. I don't want to name any names, but I've looked at the New York Times bestseller list recently in like the self-help category, and you know, sort of like the posture of some of the titles that are doing really, really well kind of trouble me about what a person who would buy such a book might think about themselves. I guess I'd be very vague, but I'm trying not to hurt anybody's feelings.
I know what you're alluding to, and you know that would sell more books.
But to your point earlier about maybe not reaching as many people, but reaching a smaller amount of people more deeply, I think is really important.
I think it is, and. That, you know, that's important. That's an important message for us all to think about when we think about the power of ideas, you know, narrow and deep, as opposed to, you know, shallow and wide. We can still create sustainable businesses. We don't have to reach everybody. We don't have to compromise our values. We can do work we care about. We can do work we're proud of, and that's a big deal, right?
Yeah, and that's another thing that I've noticed with thinking about data over the years. I've had blog posts that you know get 100,000 views. I've had blog posts get 30,000. Then I've had some that you know maybe a few hundred or 1,000 people read it. But then that last one, while maybe the other one was read by a lot more people, that last one that might be the one where, for some reason, I'll just get like a lot of personal messages about that particular post. And somebody will say, wow, thanks for writing this. This really changed something for me.
So how does that make you feel? And how does that change what you do with your work?
Oh, you're the interviewer here. Okay. I'm on your tricks, Bernadette. Okay.
I think that's important for everybody to hear, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's tricky because it's difficult to, even as a creator who, I've been doing this for more than 10 years, and I've had some successes, but you know, financially, it's still there's a lot of pressure to if you want to make a living to maybe try to do certain things, You know, sometimes those things are valid. And then there's other times when it's not you. Mm-hmm. And the big trick, though, is that things that are breakthroughs, whatever thing was a breakthrough, before that thing happened, nobody was doing that thing before. And so you can find yourself chasing something that's not you and actually miss out on an opportunity of having something, of creating something that's a bigger impact, that's more you, that just the timing happens to work out right as far as you reaching the pinnacle of your craft, people being ready for what you're presenting. It's getting a vacuum punctured, I think, is what Seth Godin calls it in Unleashing the Idea Virus.
Bingo. You know, what you've said there is eloquent and incredibly important.
And is that something that you find yourself, have you internalized that, or is that something that you have to keep working on yourself personally?
I think for all of us who have pressure, everybody feels pressure to do the thing that's going to be popular right now. And to be, we can look at the data and see how many times somebody's sharing our posts or how many readers are viewing it. And it depends on where we want our focus to be. You know, is it just because it's more shared, does it mean that it's creating more impact?
Yeah, I think this is a perfect time to talk about your publishing career then. Because mm-hmm. you self-published 5 books, mm-hmm. I think, right? And yeah. they've been very well received. And now you're mm-hmm. now you're with a traditional publisher. How yeah. has that been different? Have you felt that pressure in working at that scale?
I think it's different because it's like working. You're more responsible for other people in the team, right? It's like being a solopreneur yes. as you are, and then you have you start hiring employees. Not that these are people that I'm collaborating with in working, you know, across a portfolio, amazing people in the industry who have got a wealth of knowledge, incredibly smart people who have been, you know, it's an amazing opportunity to work with them. And I feel responsible to make a success of things also for them, because you have an obligation to people once you start taking other people's interests into account. It's not just about doing what you think is the right thing to do. You have to consider what's right for other people who have got other obligations. So there are other factors to consider.
Mm-hmm. And in the past, was there at least one of your books where you started to work with a publisher and then you ended up self-publishing it?
Yeah, there was. Did you read that somewhere?
It was another podcast conversation. I do my research.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that happened with the Fortune Cookie Principle. So I had a book deal with the publisher for that. And we were going along and they wanted me to change things. And I just said, you know, we just do not share the same vision for this book. This is not, they wanted me to compromise on my values, which thankfully this current publisher, of course, didn't. We were very aligned and they're an mm-hmm. amazing team in a portfolio in New York and the UK. And as soon as I sent that email, I got an email back which said, and the subject line was termination of contract. So there was no discussion. And at that point, I thought my instinct was right. They weren't the right people to work.
Wow, you dodged a bullet.
I so did. And that, you know, that made me really happy. And for anybody listening, it's so important to make sure that your values and the values of the people who you work with are aligned, because you will never be happy. You, no matter how many products or services you sell or how much revenue you generate, it's definitely, you know, that's not, you'll never feel successful if you have to compromise on your values.
So when you received that email, how long did it take before you felt like, I'm going to be okay?
As soon as I received it, I just felt a rush of relief that they that I was at the point where I was going to have a legal battle, I thought, to get out of this contract. Oh. I was just so desperate to pull the plug on it, and they did me a massive favor, thankfully.
And but at that point, do you then, like, you have money in the bank from this publisher, right?
Yeah.
And you have to, like, send it back.
Yep. And I was so happy to do that. I could not tell you. I was so happy to give it back to them.
Wow. That's, I mean, you've got to really have your values and your principles figured out to, I think, handle a situation like that, you know, without it, and have it feel good, you know?
Well, here's the thing, you know, personally, on a couple of levels, I've got three sons, and I want to be able to do work that I'm proud of so that, you know, I'm a good example to them.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, and this is an inspiration and motivation for a lot of the work that I do. I lost my brother when he was 31, and he died in the year 2000. And I often think about, you know, if when he was 21, he knew he had 10 years left, what would he have done with those 10 years? And, you know, what wouldn't he have done? And, you know, in the year 2000, think about all the things he never got the chance to see, or opportunities he never got the chance to have. And here we are, here I am with the opportunity to do meaningful work on my own terms and to reach people across the world, because I live in Australia and I can speak to you in Colombia, and how fantastic is that? So, yeah, that really centers me.
Did it take you very long to be able to internalize that? Was that a tool that you had to remind yourself of at various points before it became second nature for you?
I've never asked myself that question. I think it's subconscious, really. It's there in the back of your mind always. And
you never have like a moment of tension where you're like, I don't really know what to do, and then you remind yourself of the preciousness of life, I guess, and then make that different decision.
I also think having three grown-up sons who are watching and you know, still learning. Mm-hmm. From me, I think anybody who's listening who's got kids will know the feeling of the obligation to do the right thing in the world.
Your story with the with that publisher, it reminds me of, you know, not too long ago I had a chance to join a podcast network, and I was very excited about that because, you know, podcasting is a lot of work and you never know when, mm-hmm. when it's going to become solvent.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really thought I had made the big break, but then after reviewing the contract, thinking about it for a couple of weeks and, you know, I ended up passing it up. And then my download numbers went down. And then I started wondering, well, gosh, did I make the right decision? But a couple of things have happened since then to where, well, first of all, right, it doesn't matter. As long as I get to retain my own values in doing what I'm doing, that's the most important thing. But it actually helped motivate me, I think, to push further for myself. Now, how about yourself? When that contract was terminated with that book, do you think that made your book better?
I think it made me better in that it made me understand that it was worth standing up for my values and that I shouldn't compromise. And it wasn't worth the trade-off of reaching for this thing that is a holy grail of success, whether that's, you know, more sales or making the list or receiving funding or some outward measure. Because those things are worthless if you can't sit and be proud of the work that you've done.
Mm-hmm. You've gotten a chance to work very closely with Seth Godin. I can sense that in the values that you have. I'm sure many of those values are, of course, just inherent to you. Are there elements of these things that you learned from working with Seth?
what I learned from working with Seth is the power of intention and the power of persistence and trust and all of those things, you know, that we should all do every day when we're being our best selves. You know, Seth is a phenomenal human being who just gives, yeah, and has done, given every day with no expectation of receiving anything in return. And the world will be a better place if more of us were like that.
So when it comes to any of those lessons, such as, say, persistence, was there any particular moment when you recognized that and you remember feeling some kind of a change in yourself to be more persistent?
I am pretty dogged by nature, but not in a grasping way, just in an incremental way. I do believe that change doesn't happen overnight, and that we just need to make sustained effort, you know, not to expect things to happen in a moment. And I'm here for the long game. My publisher was having a conversation with me today about, you know, goals for the book and my latest book. And I said, you know, my goal every day is to enable myself to get up and do what I do again tomorrow, and to do things that I love again tomorrow. And which is what your podcast is about, you know, do work you love.
And they didn't send you a termination email after that?
Well, no, because the thing is, you can have an instant New York Times bestseller, as you've alluded to, and that's all very well. But will people still be picking up your book 10 years from now? I mean, that's a marker of success, isn't it? When you've got a book like Simon Sinek's Start With Why, and it's still selling, and it's still in the top 100, and people are still sharing it with other people. You know, the marker of success for your podcast and for my work is if somebody says, oh, you really need to read this book, or you really need to listen to this podcast, it changed something for me. So it's to have impact over time, not just to hit the list or to make the most sales or to beat somebody else. And that's easier said than done at times, because we're all human, right? We like to measure things.
And it works best if you are able to connect with your own humanity and with your own identity and create your work through that. I think that's what resonates.
Yeah, it takes work, right? I'm not 20 years of age, you know. I've lived a number of years. I wouldn't say I was like this at 20, you know. It takes time. It takes self-knowledge and a little bit of self-belief. And
do you wish that your 20-year-old self could have been more like that, or
could any 20-year-old self be like that? I don't think it's possible. I think we need to go through those doubts and fears. I'm not saying any of us can be fearless at the age of 50, no more than we were at 20. I think we learn to live with it a little bit better.
Don't you ever meet any 20-year-olds where you're like, oh man, why wasn't I that smart when I was 20?
What are we admiring in them, I guess? Is it smart, or is it?
I think it's self-awareness, or
self-aware. Yeah,
like being free of the arrogance or self-assuredness that is, you know, typically associated with young age. And then I think that's the thing that I will usually see where I'm like, oh man, I wish I could have learned to that level by the time I was that age.
And then you wouldn't be who you are. You know, everybody, what makes our each individual contribution unique is that we've lived through that life that we've lived through and been on that particular journey.
Yeah. So Bernadette, thank you for chatting with me today. I know that you have an extremely busy week there in New York. Do you have a final message to kind of sum up our conversation today?
I think the title of your podcast is amazing, and the message that you're putting out is amazing. And I would just say to people, be true to yourself, and think about the people you're creating for, and then you'll do work you love.
Great. And where can people find more of you, Bernadette?
My blog is thestoryoftelling.com.
Wonderful. Bernadette Jiwa, thank you.
Thanks, David. It's been a joy to talk to you.
I hope that conversation with Bernadette Jiwa helps you connect with your hunch and stay true to your values. For more on sticking with your values, listen to Jason Fried on episode 1. We dig deep into the origins of Jason's famously contrarian views on how to do business.
Something I hear from people when I speak, and they're like, oh, I want to be like you guys. I'm like, no, you don't. You want to be like you. You want to be like you, because acting is hard. Mm-hmm. Acting makes you have to hold a bunch of things in your head about a different state of the world that is not natural to you. And once you stop acting, then everything becomes a lot easier. And you may succeed and you may not, but at least you're being honest and true to yourself. That is the most important thing.
Again, Jason is on the very first episode of Love Your Work. You might also enjoy Ryan Holiday on episode 31. Ryan talks about how to separate the ego from the siren song of success.
You know, this firm that you watch become a billion-dollar company suddenly, you know, be not far from bankruptcy, and a mentor of yours get fired by the board of the directors, all in a sudden sort of momentous event. It makes you wonder, you know, what happened? Is this a path that I'm on? Could something like this happen to me?
Again, Ryan is on episode 31. And if you appreciate all the work that goes into making this show, there are a couple of ways you can help support it. One is to subscribe, whether it is on Apple Podcasts, Overcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Just hit the subscribe button. Another is to rate the show. On Overcast, it's really easy. Just tap the star icon on this episode. On Apple Podcasts, just go to cadavy.net/apple. Click on write a review and click on the star rating. You don't even have to write a review. It really just takes a couple of seconds. You can also join Love Your Work Elite. You'll get access to episodes before everyone else. You can even get ad-free interviews weeks in advance, and you can get your name or business mentioned in the credits of the show. For details, go to cadavy.net/elite. That's cadavy.net/elite. Love Your Work is brought to you in part by top Love Your Work Elite members such as Arif Akhtar. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for this show is More Streets, performed by Spiderflower. Love Your Work is a production of Cadavy, Inc.